The question originally was about moral principles. Should we decide on moral principles? Neil Kinnock was rejected by this electorate, by the British electorate, on two separate occasions. He then resigned, went off to the European Commission, and took upon himself greater powers than our Prime Minister. Is it morally right that a man who is unelected and rejected by the British population then takes upon himself more power? Is it morally right that the European Commission have spent the last 3 years negotiating in secret the TTIP with the Bilderberg Group at their backing? Is it morally right that these people have power over us and we don't have the democratic right to get rid of these people that we don't want? Can you
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. George Orwell said, "He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past." For our final show from the good old Beacon Centre at the City Academy and Russell Town Avenue, we take a look at the statue mania gripping the United States and what it says about somewhat hand-fisted attempts to control history by today's deep state control freaks. Also, as Bristol schools prepare to start a new academic year with about 1,000 less teachers, we look again at the privatisation of education, the infantilism of the mainstream media churnout, and austerity as the unhinged elite's key weapon against the 99%. Plus, in the wake of the Barcelona attacks, are there fascists hiding in European police forces? We know all about the Golden Dawn in Greece, or you should do if you don't. And could they be killing terror suspects? Not because they're dangerous, but because the police don't want to have to face a trial. Forget the BBC, who never question what the security forces tell. How does former German security minister Andreas von Bülow think that modern terror operations are carried out? Our sister show Dialects, back again on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week we take a trip over to Stroud to discover it was here and not up north that the Industrial Revolution really began. The first of the world's dark satanic mills are now mostly converted to luxury flats. Plus former CIA agent Susan Lindauer on the Charlottesville backstory. That's Dialect at noon every Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, let's start by looking at some pretty much unreported news, and that is about the Russian economy.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is the fact that the Russians this week paid off the debt that was owed from the Soviet era and are now clear of all the debts of that era.
It's a bit like about 2009, I think it was, that Gordon Brown finally paid off the Lend-Lease from the Second World War to the US.
Mm. Well, obviously, because of the sanctions on Russia, they've been having to reconsider their relations with the rest of the world. They're a big country, they've got a lot of resources. They were in pretty much free fall in the 1990s, which is when most of this debt was run up. And they haven't completely written off the whole of their debt, but the debt from the Soviet era is now gone. And, of course, they're trying to basically allow themselves to be free of outside pressures because they can see that that's going to lead to them losing geopolitically if they're not.
There are two add-ons to this. One is that they also took on the debt of a lot of other ex-Soviet countries who simply refused to pay it. The Russians said, oh, well, OK, Moscow will pay them, which is a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians actually owe a lot of money to the Russians, which was lent to them when they were in trouble. earlier, this not that long
this
ago.
This is since that, isn't it? This is more recent. The other thing,
but they're not paying, and the Russians are taking to the court in London to get them to pay. And of course, if they don't pay, then the courts in London will be shown to be biased and so on and so forth.
The other thing
that should lead to other countries refusing to pay.
The other things the Russians have done is actually to forgive quite a lot of countries that had that the Soviet era had lent money to, forgive them their debt completely. Like, for example, tens of millions, hundreds of millions loaned to Cuba. They've said, oh, you don't have to pay that. So they've actually done rather well, haven't they, really, in that they're now in a situation where this debt has gone. There is still some remaining, but the likelihood surely now is that the Russian economy is going to start to take off.
Well, then, they're still dependent on relations with the West. If there's a crash in China, for example, the Russians will feel it, and we will feel it. We're all related. Everything's related
but
to everybody
far
else.
Less, they haven't got that debt anaconda strangling them like we have with our $1.5 trillion debt.
Well, no, yes, well, we've got a debt, but we've also got a very good credit rating, and we can print our own currency. So there's no chance of a British default, in fact. That's delusionary. The problem is that there's too much debt in the world. It's been run up for many years.
They've been talking in the US about the debt ceiling as well this week, haven't they?
Yeah.
So why is the debt ceiling important?
Well,
it seems to me that you've got a situation where the banks will simply, some countries, if they think that they can bamboozle through massive extra debts, they'll then say, oh, okay, well, we'll allow quantitative easing in order for you to be able to pay some of that back. It's not a realistic situation, is it?
Well, what happens is there's no fairness in it. Big countries, strong countries, countries that the West likes, they get let off their debts. So Poland and Egypt, for example, both let off 50% of their debts. Poland in 1990 because as a reward for Solidarnosc. Egypt in 1991 as a reward for supplying the military to invade Kuwait and kick out the Iraqis. But that was nothing to do with, it was just a political decision, and of course political decisions are made to let some people off debts and other people not. The Greeks voted in 1953, as did various other countries, for Germany's debts to all be wiped out and the slate to be wiped clean. Germany seems to forget that as it squeezes the stone yet again in Greece.
Okay, so also Steve Bannon's resignation happened just after show finished last week. And that Trump presidency we fought for, says Zero Hedge, is over. Various people saying similar sorts of things, that actually he was the last person who was really there sticking up for Trump, and he's now gone.
Well, I mean, I was never a supporter of Trump anyway, and anybody who voted for Trump expecting that he was going to defy Wall Street and the Pentagon are absolutely deluded.
Well,
of course he's not going to defy
them,
and he isn't defying them, is he?
One of the US analysts, Mike Krieger, has said that it's now the Goldman Sachs presidency.
And also the Pentagon. Don't forget that all these generals have now. I mean, Trump for years and years and years says we're going to get out of Afghanistan. He's changed his mind. No, we're going to double down on Afghanistan. And that's because he's basically a puppet. He was always a puppet, even when he pretended he wasn't a puppet, so that people would vote for it.
Does it matter? I mean, surely all these presidents.
Well, it does matter in the long run, of course. If you've got a country that's run by puppets of the military-industrial complex with no democratic accountability, ultimately, when it comes to World War III and you're fighting the Russians, who have actually built a democratic state which is solvent, you're going to lose. That's how important it is.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour about terror operations. We were talking last week a lot about the Barcelona, some of the anomalies in there. The main one, I suppose, is because there's no main survivors from these main so-called attacks, that there is never going to be any kind of court case.
Well, the other thing, that's very obviously important, because if everybody's dead, then there's never any jury to look at anything. And of course, the mastermind now turns out to be this Iman, which the authorities in Spain have been warned about by the Belgian authorities. So it looks like, to me, as if this could be a let it happen on purpose rather than a made it happen on purpose attack. But of course, the suspicion has always got to be with these attacks that there is a role for the state security forces and intelligence services, and when the police investigate these attacks, they've got to bear that in mind, because the track record is, going back decades, that NATO intelligence services foment terrorism, Islamist terrorism.
Is it possible there are fascists in the Spanish police?
Yes, it's very possible. Don't forget, Spain was a fascist country until 1978, and the police are the place where, not so much the Catalonian police, but it doesn't really matter. The fact is that we still don't know exactly what's happened here. It's obviously extremely regrettable and unpleasant, and to be condemned, whoever's behind it. But in recent years, British Special Forces and Intelligence Services have been arming and training jihadis in Jordan and in Turkey, and then we claim, oh, what happened here? These jihadis are blowing things up. Well, that's because we've been helping them to do that.
Now, Chris Bolin is an author of Solving 9/11 and various other books. He's just got another one out recently as well. But he spoke a while ago to Sean Stone, the son of Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, who does something called the Buzzsaw program in the US. And he was writing about 9/11 pretty much straight away after. But he is talking about his experience actually just directly after 9/11, writing about it, and also about the modern terror operations today. He was told that there are three main areas that are involved in planning these operations. There's one is the planners, the architects, the people who brainchild, the masterminds, if you want. Then there's a kind of managerial level, which is where these plans are carried out. And thirdly, a working level, where Martin, he talks about the Arab hijackers, for example, just being the working level. In other words, you won't see anything about how the attack was coordinated if you look at them.
No.
So is that your analysis?
Well, I mean, it's similar to Tarpley's analysis of the moles, who are the perpetrators, the real perpetrators, the technicians who actually carry out the attacks, and the patsies, the people who get the blame. And all three strands have to be coordinated for these terror attacks to work. And this goes back to Gladio in the 1940s and onwards, and this is standard NATO operating procedure.
OK, well, there will be no show. This show won't be happening next week because the radio station is moving over to the Eastern Community Centre, but... We'll be talking quite a lot more about this kind of thing then in 2 weeks' time, when we have a special about terrorism and 9/11. And in the meantime, though, here's Chris Bolin talking about his experience immediately as a writer after 9/11 and a journalist.
I was writing these articles in my little home in Schaumburg, Illinois, in September, October, and November of 2001, as the country was going to war. And I saw that the government and the media were giving us this really false narrative. And all the evidence that contradicted that was being swept under the table. And they're going to war on that. And I said, how safe can it be for me to be here? So we went to Germany. I transferred and started working as a foreign correspondent in Germany after Thanksgiving in 2001. And the first person I met in Germany was basically Andreas von Bülow. I met him at his house. And he was the former German parliamentarian who was in charge of the budgets for the intelligence agencies in Germany. And I spoke to three people like him. And they all told me that it looked like a Hollywood deception. They couldn't understand why a Blue Ribbon investigation wasn't happening. And Andreas von Bülow explained to me that in this kind of operation, there's an architectural level, a managerial level, and a working level. And the working level is part of the deception. So like the 19 Arabs, for example, who were on the planes and not on the planes, whatever, the false trail of these 19 Arabs, that is the one part of the deception. But the managerial level, you would find people like Alvin K. Hellerstein, the judge in New York, who oversaw the tort litigation, in which all 3,000 cases were settled out of court. There will never be a 9/11 trial. All the victims' families were settled out of court. Mm-hmm. Even the 100 families that held out mm-hmm. for a trial, they were all settled out of court.
Right.
And of course, Michael Chertoff, he's the head cop. How do you sue the head cop? But in any case, he was the guy who was supposed to prosecute the crime. There was no 9/11 trial. There never will be.
Right.
Because if there were a trial, there would be legal discovery. And we could ask questions like, how did these guys get on the plane? Did they get on the plane? Let's see the videos, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty good summary of the way these things work. And if people are interested in this, they should look up the term Gladio, because that's the historical name for NATO's secret false flag terrorist operations, which were operating in Western Europe from the 1940s onwards. So there's a pattern here. 9/11 didn't come out of a blue sky.
But it does seem that there's been this increase in terrorist attacks, even though there's been lots more surveillance. There's a whole load more of various rights and powers that the police have, and yet the terrorist attacks are increasing.
Yeah, well, that's the purpose of these attacks. The purpose of the attacks is to allow a police state to be put in place. So the more attacks there are, the more the security services demand powers, resources, etc. And of course, they're the ones who are ultimately allowing and making these things happen.
False flag terrorism has now become the new norm. After 9/11, that's the seminal event of our time. But afterwards, like the recent events in Denmark and in Paris and in Kenya, and in, you know, many of these attacks, most of these attacks are more of the same, false flag terrorism. And so what I recommend to viewers, your viewers, is that they read John le Carré's book, The Little Drummer Girl. Because in that book, it was written with the help of the Mossad. They explain in the 1980s exactly how Israel sets up such things like the Paris shooting or the Danish shooting and how they do it. And 9/11. I mean, for example, the six or seven so-called Arab terrorists who were living in Florida all had duplicate licenses issued in their name. You see? So somebody else was going around town leaving a trail in their name. And that's what Little Drummer Girl is all about, how they do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, now when we see Islamic State committing atrocities week after week, day after day, what's interesting to note is that all of the videos, the video evidence, is coming out of one little Israeli website called Site Intelligence Group. I think it's based in McLean, Virginia. And the woman who runs it is named Rita Katz. And she was on CNN when the second American beheading video was shown on TV. Mm-hmm. She told on CNN, she explained that it just so happens that we aired this film before the group aired the film because we had a copy beforehand. Well, how did they have a copy beforehand?
Well, that's a very good question. People should look at Rita Katz's website. That is the source of most of the Islamic State's propaganda, and it's run by an ex-Mossad intelligence agent. Go figure.
And Barcelona, we were told to tweet Katz, weren't we, instead of... was this some sort of in-joke? What's that about?
Well, I don't think that's necessary. That's just a coincidence, Tony.
OK, but in Germany, we had a near attack a few months ago, didn't we, where a German soldier was found to have been actually planning an attack himself in Vienna Airport in a similar sort of way to...
Well, he created a false identity as a Syrian refugee, but the police managed to catch him. And that's the answer to this. The police, the democratically responsible police forces of the world, have to get off their hands and start looking at the intelligence services
as
sources of terrorism.
Martin, you know as well as I do, even senior police, senior detective inspectors, etc., are told, sorry, it's national security, and they have to just get out of the way.
Well, what they have to do is say that's not good enough. In Colombia a few years ago, the National Police raided army headquarters to thwart Operation Dragon, which had been put together by the Colombian army. They were going to assassinate all the trade union leaders in the country over a two-week period. The police thwarted it. Nobody was ever punished, of course. And that's the problem. Even if the police act,
I mean,
then nothing gets done.
If the police try to act, then they're trumped, aren't they, by people like the security services.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the Provisional IRA wouldn't trust the police from 1969 onwards and killed hundreds of them. But then, of course, they decided in the end that was a mug's game and they gave it up. But people need to realise that those are the choices.
And what about the end of the IRA campaign came not long after they started blowing up places in the City of London? So it was a financial reason in some ways.
Well, the attack on the Baltic Exchange led to a situation where you couldn't get private sector insurance against terrorist attack in Britain. And at that point, Major picked up the hotline to the IRA and said, it's about time we had a chat.
Up but nothing!
A band of Irish laddies were knocking up some tricks. They thought Horatio Nelson had overstayed a mite, so they helped him on his way with some sticks of jelly kite. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. All along O'Connell Street the stones and royal through, as up went Nelson and the bill. The Irish population came from miles around to see the English hero lying on the ground. The Dublin Corporation had no funds to have it done, but the pillar blew to pieces by the ton, ton, ton.
Up went old Nelson in old Dublin. and it'll drop them. All along of Canada's sweet, the stones and rubble flew, as up went Nelson and the builder too. A crowd of lads and lassies from a dance nearby came out to see the bits of Nelson lying all about. A gusser from the boom says we'll have to have a care in case the corporation put King Billy there. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. Up went Nelson in old Dublin. All along O'Connell Street the stones and rubble flew, as up went Nelson and the pillar too. Up went Nelson and the pillar.
Well, that was number one in the Irish charts for several weeks back in 1966 when Nelson's Pillar in O'Connell Street in Dublin was blown up by the IRA after there'd been a bit of a discussion and a debate. And I just thought it might be interesting to start our discussion because I've got Christine Townsend from the Celtic Colston Group, a former teacher, and also William Brown from the Bristol National Union of Teachers in the studio. Just to start our discussion is about just is to focus, to have a little look at this whole incident in Ireland where the IRA decided that they'd had enough of Nelson looking down on Dublin. I dug up an old report which was just a year or so before Nelson's Pillar was blown up by famous the guy that used to fly around the world, Alan Wicker, did an interview over there, which may have even been partly involved in precipitating the IRA to decide to finally do something about it. But anyway, here's Alan Wicker now.
Well, let's say a lot of us are not enamoured of what he represents or the philosophy or frame of mind that erected the column in the first place.
So what do you want to see happen to him?
What I would like to do would be to put a plaque, something to this effect, that this monument was erected by an alien ascendancy. In its shadow, Pierce and Connolly fought to end that ascendancy. Let us salute their memory and strive to complete their work.
But you wouldn't do anything to Nelson himself. You'd leave him there in all his composure.
You're trying to put a half Nelson on me now. I'm not quite too sure about that. There's the attitude of mind of the genuine 100% Dubliner, who feels, particularly if he's away from Dublin, a certain nostalgia for his native city. And one of the outstanding landmarks to him is that column sticking up skywards. He has no love for Nelson, or he has no love for what Nelson represented. But he has an affection for, the irreverent phrase is sometimes being used, an affection for the one-eyed, one-armed old adulterer.
We have no objection to statue to Nelson in himself. We do have an objection to his present location. Put him up in the Phoenix Park, because I think the further away from him you are, is the nearer he might come to a thing of beauty.
The one-armed, one-eyed old adulterer, they called him in Ireland. He didn't last very long after that interview. Now, the whole business of whether a statue should be allowed to left has really kind of exploded in the US. I noticed, Christine, that the University of Texas in Austin overnight actually took down quite a lot of statues of people who were sort of supporters of the Confederacy, but some of them were were governors of the state after the whole Civil War had long finished, or sort of 10, 15 years afterwards. So this is a bit of a contentious issue, isn't it?
Well, it has, and you're right. It's kind of taken us all a bit by surprise, maybe, in Bristol and in Britain. But, you know, certainly I have learnt a lot more about Confederate statues, about numbers, about when they were put up, about the fact that a lot of them are hollow when they were mass-produced. So the act of, and the unfortunate incidents that are going on in America, and the kind of the social sort of unrest around these statues, what it actually is doing is bringing out the history that those that would argue they should be kept, actually is bringing out some history that maybe people didn't know. I certainly didn't know that they were put up at certain times in the last century, or that a lot of them are hollow.
It's interesting, isn't it? Well, tell us about that hollow. Why are they hollow, some of them? Why is that significant?
Because if you watch some of the footage of when these statues are toppled, they buckle. So I saw an online video about this guy that was explaining why it is that they were buckled, and they were particularly after the in the 20s and the 30s, and there was this massive rush from towns and cities in the south to get these certain types of these monuments up in their kind of public places. And actually what it was there was a particular company that were mass producing these statues, because marble or solid metal it takes a long time to make, and it's very, very expensive. And so these particular types of monuments are a lot cheaper.
Also, I mean, people are less likely to steal them, maybe, if they know they're only if they're hollow, because the metal is worth quite a lot of money. But this is really about trying to control history, isn't it? And that's what your group is interested in.
Well, and it's also about who is celebrated and seen in public spaces. It's also about that, isn't it? And it's about how history is particularly told by one side, if you like, and trying to get the whole of the history much more understood and better understood and better represented in public spaces.
Also, he was saying there about maybe moving the statue rather than having it right in the city centre, having it, sticking it in a museum somewhere. He said, talked there about Phoenix Park, so it's kind of out of the way, so it's not right in your face in a public way. But what do you think about the rights and wrongs of what's been going on in the US? This is this is where this story kind of started, didn't it, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, on a personal level, there's something about young people, older people, all sorts of different people, thinking about why that particular person is there in the middle of their, so, you know, in the centre of their town. Why? Who is that person? What did they do? And do we want to continuously see that particular person, or should there be somebody else there? And, you know, history and the way in which history is remembered and researched and different points of what happened in the past, that comes out all the time.
Well, the guys over in Dublin talking to Alan Wicker, and they were saying, well, and in fact, no, I think it was in the song, actually, saying that if we're not careful, they'll put King Billy up in the middle of Dublin. Now, he was one of the big enemies, really, of the ordinary Irish people. He was one of the people that went and fought over there. And then we were discussing last week about the English Civil War on here, and the statue of Charles I, where when Cromwell won the English Civil War, he said, you've got to take this statue down. But the guy, instead of melting it down, actually hid it, buried it or something. And then once the restoration happened, the statue came back up again. So this is actually quite, it's about the present. I think I just love that George Orwell quote where he talks about the, what is it? I'll just read it out again because I like it so much. He who controls, of course it starts with a he. He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. And it seems that's where we are at the moment. This whole business about if you are able to say these are important figures from the past now, you're starting to define the whole direction of society.
Yes, I would agree. And I think it's also important to remember who it was that defined who was important at the time. Because certainly when the Confederate statues went up, well, the civil rights movement hadn't started, had it? And so there wasn't universal suffrage in the United States. When the Colston statue went up, it was before women got the vote. So it wasn't a democratic decision. It wasn't something that was by the people for the people. These were monuments to people that were considered to be good people, elite people, people that wanted to be remembered by a particular faction of society. And that's also part of the historical understanding.
When did the Colston statue go up? Do you know?
Late 19th century.
Okay, so that was before there was any kind of universal suffrage at all. So you had to have a property. You had to own a certain amount of property in order to vote. So it's even worse than just women. It's almost everybody not being able to vote. This is when we had all the rotten boroughs and this kind of thing. Interesting stuff. Anyway, so I've been reading recently about Christopher Columbus and statues of him. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I did read an article around what it actually says under some of these statues about Christopher Columbus discovered these lands as if the native inhabitants didn't exist. It's like this it didn't exist before white males got there.
Well, certainly the Native Americans weren't very good at putting up statues in town centres, were they, at the time, and making sure they were remembered. And they probably couldn't read and write and this kind of thing. So that technology around building, architecture, town planning, and also literature is really about what this is about. It's about not about what people were feeling and thinking at the time. It's about who's got control of that technology.
Yeah, of course. And who and what messages are going to go into the future? Because, you know, this is part of the furniture, if you like, of the towns and the cities in which we live. And that has deep kind of subconscious impacts on the way that people think and feel about themselves and about their city and about others that they're living with. And that is what statues are about. That's what street furniture is. That's why we have these blue plaques, isn't it, on the sides of houses that say about particular people that lived in particular places. You know, that's there are reasons that these things go up. And it's about who put it up, why they put it up, and when it was put up.
So what's happening with your campaign, the Counter Colson campaign, which, I mean, I was involved with a little bit a couple of years ago in exposing, I suppose, the rather pernicious activities of Bishop Mike in the cathedral with a captive audience of hundreds of school children when he was questioning as to whether it seemed as if whether Edward Colson was even involved in making money from the slave trade. He said this was speculation, you know, quite clearly this is actually deceiving the children, and the bishop really shouldn't be doing that.
Absolutely, and I think that was the latest spark, to be honest, Tony, around a small group of people that are building on what other generations have done in Bristol before. I mean, you know, we happen to call it Countering Colston, but this has been going on certainly since I was a kid and possibly before that. And what's happened, what some of the historians have done in recent times, is gone back to the primary sources, and they've looked at the actual numbers of enslaved Africans, both that were transported but also those that died before they got to the islands in the Caribbean. And those pieces of research and that knowledge has now become kind of more widely known, if you like. It's in the public domain in the way it hasn't been previously. And those numbers are now actually being quoted because it's clearly the best piece of historical research that exists. I'm shocked that nobody's done that research, to be honest, around Edward Colston. So, that's been going on. The Colston Primary School is consulting as to whether they feel that they should change the name of their primary school. As a group, we had nothing to do with that. That was something that kind of came off the back of what was going on at the Colston Hall and the debate that has kind of, you know, we've had now over the last 12 months or so again in Bristol. And hopefully, you know, this might be the time when we do get the history out and we do have the permanent displays, particularly in the Colston Hall, because they need to document the history that has been that they and others have made over the last couple of decades around why the name of that building has changed.
I went and had a look in the M shed at the exhibition supposedly about the slave trade. Well, there's quite a lot about the slave trade in there. It's one little corner, there's no mention of the merchant venturers, which almost seems deliberate to me, because it's such an obvious thing to talk about, these being the people who profited from the slave trade in Bristol, who still exist, who are still quite powerful today, and yet they're not there, which I found pretty eye-opening, I must admit. But then also we've got John Cabot, who he was in a way a kind of reconnaissance mission for the colonisation, not the discovery. Can we just say this is a colonisation going on here? You're not discovering something, you're colonising it, you're taking it over, you're privatising it effectively, you're saying it's ours and we're going to do what with you what we will. And that actually led to the it's a holocaust really of Native Americans. Some quote in North and South America combined up to 100 million people dying because of the colonization. So this is really quite a running sore in a way. And to have Colston still being kind of celebrated and also Cabot too, with Cabot Circus, with the Cabot Tower, all this stuff. You know, people might say, well, Cabot really had nothing to do with it. Well, actually, as we've been told here by the chap from the Colston Project up at Bristol University, it was the same families involved in financing Cabot and then creating the Merchant Venturers.
And, you know, the Merchant Venturers are still around. And some of those families are going to be able to trace their families back quite a long way, I've no doubt. But the idea that Cabot discovered anything is just nonsense, isn't it? It's the way in which it's been documented and portrayed and therefore taught. And that becomes part of people's subconscious understanding of their own identity and the identity of their own country or their own city. And that has, and it's the emotional attachments that go along with that that I think need to be broken down. So people need to be able to understand, yes, from the actual, let's expose the entirety of the history and let's see it from a different perspective. But those emotional attachments will take time for, particularly for Bristolians, to be able to let go and replace it with something else. I mean, the idea that the Matthew ship, you know, we've got this replica ship, haven't we, down in the docks, this wooden ship. It would be very interesting to see what's on that ship in terms of what Cabot did and what it actually says and how much of the entirety of the history is actually recorded in that ship. I mean, I've never been on it. Maybe it's something I need to go and do as a local Bristolian.
Seems to be off quite often. It seems to be away at sea. I don't know what they're up to with it. But yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, though, the merchants are still with us today as an organisation, and they will say that they're very charitable. Of course, the former mayor George Ferguson was a former merchant. The guy that's the chair of the United Hospital Bristol NHS Trust, John Savage, is a former merchant. He's now left, apparently. He's not on the list officially anymore, and he's spending £500 million every year of our money. At least he's in charge of that, and he's very reluctant to ever come and talk about it on the radio. I've never managed to actually, well, I put many requests in, never ever managed to get him to come and talk, even though it's supposed to be running a public service. These people do seem, it does have a sort of cult-like feel to it, where, I mean, do you think that's fair to talk about the cult of Colston? Because what people like Colston have achieved is a massive wealth fund, which really means that the people who are part of it, they and their children will never have to work again. They've got fantastic amounts of money, almost infinite amount. Well, it's not infinite, but, you know, hidden amounts of money in tax havens, almost certainly, which they don't have to declare because it's a royal charter, and this kind of material is not, you don't have to talk about it in a company's house. You don't have to deliver tax returns, all this sort of thing, to company's house, an annual report. So it is a kind of cult. It's extremely secretive, and the idea is that they're passing this wealth down through generations.
We haven't come up with this term cult of Colston. This was something that was first written about that we have found as documented evidence, historical evidence, in the 1920s by the Reverend R.J. Wilkins. And this guy basically had, it appears that he was the one that had looked at Colston, but also other figures, historical figures, and was basically saying, why is Bristol so obsessed with this man? Why is it this man and not these other range of Bristolians that Bristol is interested in? And he was the one that came up with this idea of the cult of Colston. But this guy was, he was the lead of one of the Colston societies, the Colston charities. So he was also on the inside. Not only was he part of the church, which, of course, we know, the merchant venturers are also very, very pally with, but he was also on the inside in the sense that he was in and was running one of these charities. So this guy knew what he was, you know, he had access to things that meant that he came up with this term himself. We haven't invented this. This is something that has existed for the best part of, you know, a century now.
I'm also joined by William Brown, who's the secretary of the local branch of the National Union of Teachers. Before we talk about the cuts, William, I wonder if you could say what you make of this, because it does seem as if there are control freaks still out there. They're trying desperately to make sure that their version of history sticks.
Good evening. Yeah, it is interesting. There's a few perspectives to look at it from, certainly. I think the one of control and legacy is really important. I read in Ukraine, they've just finished a big national process of removing, I think, all statues of Lenin from public places. And that's seen as a real sort of poke in the eye to Russia for what's been happening in very modern geographical politics around that part of the world. Here in Bristol, I've sort of had some experience with public engagement around the legacy of Colston and his statue in recent months. We did a creative writing week at my school back in autumn, and myself and the other Key Stage 2 teachers decided we were going to teach about the slave trade.
So what age children are they?
So this was all Key Stage 2, so that's age 7 to 11. And we sort of teamed up, us teachers went away, did a bit of research, we put together a walking trail to take our children out on a sort of day, going and looking at the historically significant sites around the city. And for almost every single child, it was a total revelation. They simply had no idea that some of the famous parts of the city, some of the prestigious buildings, and some of the names which survive, come from such a sort of inglorious background, shall we say.
But at the end of the day, surely the best thing to do is to be building statues rather than taking them down. Maybe building statues of people who history has buried, or the winners have buried.
I agree. I think one of the dangers is how those statues are presented. I mean, it may be slightly controversial to say, I'm not directly against having a statue of Colston. What I am against is the text that goes with it. So on the actual plaque it says, erected by citizens of Bristol as a memorial of one of the most virtuous and wise sons of their city. Now, I do have issue with that.
Now, you were mentioning also to me, just as you arrived, Christine, about some stuff to do with Jimmy Savile, because there were kind of memorials to him that have also now been taken down.
Well, yes, it's this kind of... what I find interesting around this debate, and we saw this with that, there was an article in The Guardian earlier this week about Nelson attacking Nelson's Column in London, which is why, obviously, you're playing the song from Ireland. It was only a few years ago. I mean, and people can remember the what's gone on with Savile. It's etched in our memories. I've got a list here. I mean, this is just a Google search. So there was a 4-foot memorial of his graveyard in Scarborough that was removed in the middle of the night. There was a plaque on the side of the house where he lived that was also removed. There was a statue outside a children's swimming pool in Glasgow that was taken down. In Stoke Mandeville Hospital, there was a cafe named Jimmy's that was changed. There was a gilded plaque that was the entrance to his own VIP suite. There were they'd made tiles, like a tile memorial, with pictures that included him. Those were all taken down. And there was something called the Jimmy Savile Hospital Trust that was set up in 1981 that is no longer in operation. I don't remember a massive discussion either in the newspapers or on the radio about people objecting to any of that being taken down. Nobody said you're erasing the history of what this man did. Nobody said, but he gave loads of money to charity and we need to remember this guy. So it's the concept of removing things isn't the issue. It's about the individual itself. And this goes back to this thing around when statues or when street architecture or when how things are portrayed in museums goes into people's subconscious and it builds part of their identity and there's an emotional attachment to it. I mean, that was a real shock for probably other than those people that seemingly already knew or were survivors of his abuse. It was a massive shock. Institutions across the country, huge institutions, were scrabbling to get to see how they were going to deal with it. So it's the concept of that is kind of separate to Colston the man, Colston the legacy, or Colston the image that the Victorians have kind of created for us and left for us. And that's what we need to look at. That's what we need to analyse.
I mean, maybe you're just talking about a change in the plaque underneath Colston saying something like he was a terrible man that led to the kidnapping and murder of millions of however many million people or something like that.
Well, that's an option, isn't it? I mean, the idea.
Do we want to
that,
celebrate people like that?
Well, that's something that the people in this city need to be having a conversation about, and we are having a conversation. I've never known. I'm in my mid 40s. I've never known Colston to be so discussed as it is right now. And I think that can only be a good thing. And what I would like to do is see Marvin Rees go to our youth parliament and get our young get them to lead our young people in having this debate and see what they want. I mean, how do they think that this man needs to be remembered or you know,
if Marvin can't do it, who can?
Well, exactly. I mean, he's
someone
the mayor,
from his,
you know what I mean?
from his ethnic background, for goodness sake. I mean, so what about the governance of schools? Because the merchants have got a big role to play in that, haven't they, at the moment?
Absolutely. And what we've seen literally this week is certain individual members of the merchant venturers, along with the church, the cathedral, actually expanding their empires. Because they've taken over two, the Cathedral Trust has taken over, has announced they've taken over two new primary schools, Victoria Park and Headley Park, which is in the south. So there's still this empire building mentality, I'm going to suggest.
Well, I think you're right. It sounds to me as if the public sector is being deliberately, the funding for it is being deliberately pulled by central government, and these guys with their massive pot of gold are just going, oh, we'll have that one on the cheap.
Absolutely, yeah. We didn't see them wanting to take Mill Pond when that got inadequate, because, you know, the merchant venturers ran the City Academy for just over 10 years, but it got an inadequate Ofsted inspection. It was done for institutional racism, and they let it go. You know, I'm suspicious, should we say, about the actual benefits that certain individuals and certain institutions involved in our education system in this city actually bring, and what their motivation is. It should be the schools that are getting Ofsted falls that they're looking to take over, not the ones that are outstanding. And the two that they've just taken on are outstanding.
William, from the Secretary of the Bristol branch of the National Union of Teachers, William Brown, leaving the merchants aside for a minute, what are the academies really all about, and what's the difference in the way from way secondary schools mainly used to be run?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is I do need to preface it by saying there are some very good academies and some very good people work in some of those academies. However, I believe, and the NUT believes, there are huge reasons to be concerned. This is, to some extent, a land grab. And the ones you were talking about, being selective in which schools they take on, this is a new phenomenon. So we, collectively, not you and I, have introduced market forces to a public service. So what do we get there? We have winners and losers. So there's a modern phenomenon now called orphan schools. These are the ones which no sponsor wants to touch. They might have crumbling buildings, they might have a negative Ofsted result, they might have all sorts of problems or issues particular to that place and its community, which means it's not viable, it's not attractive for what is essentially a business to take it on. Should we allow public services to be in a state like that?
And rural schools are particularly vulnerable to this, aren't they? Because those schools that are maybe, you know, they serve very small communities, and these are generally primary schools that do this, and they might be in very rural. We're not necessarily, we're not a rural city. We're obviously, we're a city, so we haven't got rural. But this is a problem, isn't it? And what we're seeing are smaller schools that have been there, you know, decades, sometimes hundreds of years, serving local communities, actually are being forced to close because multi-academy trusts don't want to take them on because there aren't economies of scale.
And then sometimes even when they have been taken on, a multi-academy trust, a MAT, they can make a decision with zero accountability about the future of the school. There's a particular one I was reading about, St Martin in Meneage, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Cornwall. Small primary in a little village. Now, there's a multi-academy trust based elsewhere in the country, many, many miles away. They are one of the decision makers. The one who signs off on the plan whether to close it or not is a member at the Department for Education. So you've got two bodies who are making a decision on the future of a community, not just an educational institution or whether it's financially viable. They are affecting a whole community who have put forward protests, they've put forward petitions, and they're basically being brushed aside.
Yeah, sounds like a top-down decision being made from hundreds of miles away. People have got no kind of democratic input into whatsoever. But what is it like as a teacher? Is there any difference working in one type of school or another?
Yes. from my sort of current perspective with the work that I do for the union, one of the biggest things which I find myself saying over and over again is a member contacts me, upset, worried, outraged at a particular treatment they've experienced, perhaps. And my first question almost always has to be, what does your contract say? And that is one of the consequences that we are just beginning to see the sort of full scale of. when there used to be nationally negotiated decisions and terms and conditions, you could be pretty certain about what you were getting into if you signed a contract as a teacher. These days, I think you probably need to have some legal background or some employment law experience to fully understand what you're signing up for in certain academies. And I've had horror stories where a member has signed one of these contracts. They didn't read it through. They assumed, oh, I've been a teacher for decades. I'm still teaching in a school in the local area. It'll be fine. And then I look in the small print and I go, no, it's not. You've actually signed away your rights to A, B, and C, and you've agreed to take responsibility for D, E, F, whatever.
So what about cuts? Because I remember we were reporting a couple of months ago 1,000 cuts. Is that the case?
The cuts
within Bristol?
Yeah, no, the scale of the cuts is just as bad as it was, essentially. There was that slight sort of acknowledgement from the government that funding could be an issue, and they reallocated some money from within existing budgets to sort of help plug some of the gaps. There is no long-term commitment to any serious real terms increase in funding. We've got a huge number of schools running at deficit. The problem has not gone away. They've tried to kick it into the long grass, and the problem has not gone away. It's not been solved. There are no plans to solve it. There is still a lack of admission that we are facing a crisis, which is already real in some places.
Now, I know you're planning to do something about it in September, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. As part of a bigger Bristol-wide rally against austerity, the NUT are going to be teaming up with the NAHT, the People's Assembly of Bristol, and lots of other trade unions and organisations, with the backing of our Mayor, Marvin Rees. And we are essentially going to be putting out the message that things have not got better, the problem hasn't been solved, and we are hurtling, not just tiptoeing towards, we are hurtling right into a serious crisis, which is going to have long-term damage on the health, well-being of the children in this city
and
England.
Well, that's our future. That's our future you're talking about.
Absolutely. Chronic underinvestment happening now, and no plans to improve things in the near future. There's no light at the end of the tunnel.
So where and when is this taking place?
So, Saturday the 9th of March, we're going to be meeting on College Green. We're going to do a march around the city, come back, and we're going to have some speakers. I don't know if the speakers have been confirmed yet, but we're going to try and get some sort of well-respected people who have a deep understanding of the austerity narrative and its pitfalls. And then on September the 12th, Marvin and the other core city leaders are going to be presenting some of their ideas to Parliament about devolving powers and given greater budget responsibilities.
But at the end of the day, the Treasury is just going to decide, no, we're not going to give you any money.
That's what's been happening to date. People power is the only way we're going to solve this. I mean, we managed to get 6,000 people together for that last demo we did for funding for education in May. And I believe we need to keep banging that drum. We need to make it louder. We need to get more parties to realise what's actually happening. So far, I've gone and spoken to hundreds and hundreds of people about these issues, and not a single person, after they've looked at the numbers, has turned around and said, oh, actually, it should be okay. Not a single person has said that, apart from the one line that you get parroted from the Department for Education: there are record levels of funding going to schools, but it's not enough.
Well, I started off by talking about he who controls the past controls the future, he who controls the present controls the past. Well, this is about our future, folks. So, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Southfield, Stephen Clark. Also to, you just heard there, William Brown from Bristol's National Union of Teachers, and from Counter Colston, former teacher Christine Townsend. Also thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects here every Tuesday at noon. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. There's no politics show next Friday because BCFM is moving home. After 10 years in the City Academy, the rent is racking up. So sadly, as a charity, we're being forced to leave. And as I hear, there are less and less numbers at the school, so they're looking to make money elsewhere by jacking up our rent. But we'll be back, inshallah, in a fortnight with everything you paid the BBC to tell you about the 9/11 attacks. But I didn't tell you. With some of the top journalists in the world explaining what really happened, I'll hopefully be finding out who the architects were, how they carried out the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, and why.
You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1974 and Joni Mitchell. Do please join us for the politics show in 2 weeks' time. Don't let the banksters get you down. God bless.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.